If your passion lies in elite British road racing and you want an inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Bill Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast. Now, if you were hoping for a minute to catch your breath after the tide of headlines, race postponements, team announcements and rider transfers that marked the early part of this year, your luck has been out. Since our last episode, the Sweet Spot Group has announced that the Women's Tour will join the Tour Series on hiatus in 2023. British Cycling has appointed a new chief executive and revealed the venues and courses for the 2023 National Championships. And there's been highly competitive, high adrenaline, wheel-to-wheel racing, and plenty of it. In today's episode, we'll get a view from the sport's grassroots with insights from Mark Etches, organiser of the Sheffield Grand Prix and Monsell Hill Climb, and from its pinnacle with Peter Hodges, PR and Marketing Director for the Sweet Spot Group, organisers of the Tour of Britain, the Women's Tour and the Tour Series. Now joining us to discuss the action on the road and the equally intriguing developments behind the scenes are Sean Botley, a vastly experienced rider with our own Hutchinson Brother UK elite women's team, and of course, my co-host Phil Jones, the Managing Director of Brother UK. Phil, Sean, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. Well, I said there in the intro that there'd been plenty of racing, and sometimes it's easy to overlook, isn't it, given the number of announcements and developments from behind the scenes. But my goodness, the season is underway, and there's been no clearer example than the Cycle Classic. Now, the Inexo Cams Women's Cycle Classic, to give it its full title, was won by Jess Finney of AWOL O'Shea, ahead of Monica Greenwood of Das Hansling, and Fenix de Koinic's Flora Perkins. Sean, of course, was fifth. Your highest finish, Sean, I think, in your home race. And Tammy Miller, your Hutchinson Brother UK teammate, was sixth. Another fine result in a campaign that has already yielded overall victories at the Peaks 2-Day and at the Lacolle Classic. Now, a couple of days ago, we had the Men's Cycle Classic, won by Luke Lamperti of Trinity Racing, who took victory by millimetres from Tal de Decker of the Lotto Destiny Development Team, and James Mackay of Cycling Sheffield, who recorded another impressive result in an excellent season. The other big result since our last episode was Ruth Shear's victory in the Dave Peck Memorial, the opening round of the British Women's Team Cup. Now, that was Ruth's second victory in as many races, having won the Finsbury Park CC road race in Saffron Walden, and it was her second solo victory in as many races too. I mean, my goodness, Hutchinson Brother UK are going well at the moment, Sean. Your teammate, Lydia Watts, finished second to Ruth at the Dave Peck Memorial. I mean, this team is on fire, isn't it? What's it like to be part of at the moment?
It's really enjoyable being part of the team at the moment. I think we've built up some really good momentum to begin the season. It's a really good group of people and we all get on really well and we're all really behind each other when we do well, and yeah, kind of working towards the broader team goal is something that we all really get a kick out of, and it's just as nice if our teammate wins as it is if you win yourself. So it's been a really nice year so far.
Well, you've been taking it to the bigger teams overseas already, Sean. You rode in the, and I'm sure I'm going to mangle this, the Zwieder Zeronde in the Netherlands, where unfortunately you crashed and had to abandon the race. So tell us about that.
That was quite disappointing, to be honest, for me. I think, so the team took part in that race last year and the conditions were very different last year to what we experienced this year. So I think last year there was driving rain and some quite severe crosswinds that they had to deal with. But when we were over there this year, it was quite tranquil in comparison, really. And there wasn't much wind. It was cold for sure, but it was a sunny day. And although the conditions weren't as challenging, the racing was still very full on from the gun. And yeah, it was as aggressive and as kind of competitive as I was expecting it to be. There was a team of four of us that went. So it was me, Lydia, Charlie and Ruth. although I'd raced in Belgium before, I'd never raced in the Netherlands. So it was a little bit of an unknown for me, really. But yeah, I think I found my feet quite well in the race, and it was very hectic to begin with. And the bunch riding was very aggressive, very technical, but I didn't really have a problem with it at all. And I think I've made it through the more hectic part of the race. And yeah, roughly 20K in, I don't think I'd ever been further back than 15th, 20th wheel. And yeah, I was maybe 10th wheel at the time when it happened, but somebody crashed on the right-hand side of the bunch and it just ricocheted across to the left-hand side where I was. And yeah, I was on the floor before I knew it. It was very frustrating because I think I had done the difficult part and I'd made the split in the front group, and I was confident that I would have been able to stay there until the end. And it turned out to be a bunch sprint in the end, which suits my attributes as a rider. And I was confident I would have been able to pull off a good result. And being on the floor half an hour into the race was quite upsetting to begin with. But although I was very annoyed when I had to pull out and was sat in the car for the rest of the race, when I thought about it rationally as the race went on, yeah, I was quite pleased with how I had ridden and how I'd put myself in the right position to be able to achieve a result. And yeah, we're still very early in the season, and I am going to Belgium this weekend with the confidence that I can ride at that level. And although I didn't manage to pull off a result when we went to the Netherlands, I've come away from that experience confident that I can.
Well, we must just ask you to tell us also about the Cycle Classic. You provided us with a very insightful preview in our last episode and then went off and delivered your best result by finishing fifth with a magnificent ride in a breakaway that stayed away.
I think I really surpassed my expectations with the Cycle Classic, to be honest. I was going into the race fairly confident, and I knew, obviously, as I've done it before, I knew that I could get a result, and it's my home roads. I know the race really well, and I was confident I could pull off a result, but I was thinking that for me to achieve a result, I would be kind of happy with, the race would have to come down to a reduced bunch sprint, as it normally does. Yeah, I kind of positioned well throughout and made sure I never got in any trouble. And we were going over the Sommerberg for the first time. And I think when I entered the Sommerberg, that was probably the furthest back I'd been throughout the whole race so far. Maybe 35k in, and I hit the sector maybe 20th wheel, and I was just overtaking people. And then by the time we got to the end of the sector, there was a group of five and then a small gap and then me, and I had to go quite hard to cross the gap to those leading five. But I had looked ahead and clocked who was there, and I thought, if the move is going to go, that's going to stick away and I need to be there. So buried myself to get across to it. And then when I got there, I turned around and I dragged a couple of people with me, but then I couldn't see anybody else. So I thought, this is unfamiliar territory for me here, because I've never been in a proper breakaway like that before. So yeah, it was hard, and we were going pretty hard for the first 5K that we were in the breakaway. And I was starting to think, oof, I might be overstretching myself a little bit here. And we were working well and we'd pulled out a good gap straight away. And we got a time check of over a minute within 5K. And I was finding it quite difficult. And then suddenly Tammy appeared, and I have never been so pleased to see anybody in my life. I think Tammy is such a strong rider, and yeah, I knew that having her there would really make a difference. And then yeah, we kept getting time checks and the time kept going out, and it was all a very unfamiliar situation for me being in a breakaway like that. But I think the whole experience has definitely been a good confidence boost to me. And although I knew I could get a result before it, as I said, I was thinking it would have to be a bunch sprint. So immediately after I finished, coming fifth out of a breakaway of six, when as a confident sprinter, I was thinking I should be able to do better than that. That situation of being in a breakaway, I've never been in before. And I think I've taken more confidence from that ride, from being in a strong breakaway, than coming third in a bunch sprint.
Well, having seen the huge outpouring of congratulations on social media in the aftermath of that race, Sian, your performance certainly didn't go unnoticed. Phil, the Women's Cycle Classic, it's some race, isn't it? Absolute monument of the British calendar.
It looked like it delivered on every level, didn't it? Not only the women's race, but the men's race. You're looking at the race reports from both. Yeah, the race just delivers. It's well organised. Everyone wants to race it. Everyone wants to win it. But it's a hard race, as we've talked about before on this podcast. It's not an easy race to win. It's very technical, and you've got to be a certain type of rider to actually win that race. Yeah, all credit to you, Sean. I know you went in confident, but to sort of take away those learnings as well, back to the earlier point that we made, you're improving as a rider for sure. And this is giving you extra confidence, and the team is all suddenly rising up, isn't it? We're seeing this team confidence come, and you're coming to these races going, we can win this. Regardless of whether you're a Conti team or not, we think we can win. That brings a certain attitude, which I think is great for domestic racing and international racing, actually.
Well, what a brilliant way to start this episode with insights literally from inside the race. Now, I said in the introduction that only some of the action in British road racing since our last episode has taken place on the road. Quite a bit of it has occurred in the boardroom as well. And who better to ask about that than Phil? So we're extremely lucky to have Phil with us. What I'm referring to here, of course, is British Cycling's appointment of a new CEO. That's John Dutton, who becomes the Federation's third chief executive in 3 years. Now, I hope that isn't misleading. They haven't chopped and changed on an annual basis. Julia Harrington left the organisation in January 2021 and was replaced by Brian Facer, who left on October the 31st, 2022 with, and I quote, by mutual agreement of the board of directors. Now, that, of course, came in the immediate aftermath of a very controversial sponsorship deal with Shell. Now, John seems to know a bit about cycling. He served as, quote, director of readiness for the Grand Depart of the 2014 Tour de France and is currently on the board for Glasgow's hosting of the UCI World Championships this August. Phil, is John's appointment a case of third time lucky for British cycling? Certainly road racing declined under Julia Harrington's leadership, and Brian Facer was in post for less than 2 years and left, as I said, in the immediate aftermath of a highly contentious sponsorship deal with Shell. I mean, do you think they've got it right this time?
Well, he seems, on the face of it, a very capable individual, Tim. And, you know, those coded words by mutual agreement, it's words we all use as large enterprises to say something's not working. And there's normally a breakdown in confidence or communication between the board of directors and the chief executive. And it could be one or it could be the other, that the CEO is being frustrated by the board or the board are not happy with the way the CEO is performing. So clearly to come in as the third person within the space of time is going to put a lot of pressure on you as an individual to sort of go, they need to get this right. And if you look at John's credentials, they all seem to be there. Looks like a very capable individual who should do a good job. But of course, you've got somebody now that really does need to steady the ship. You really need to steady the ship now. They've had sort of crises after crises, haven't they, that have been trying to deal with. And of course, the third of those major crises being the announcement of the Shell deal, which of course didn't land at all well from a PR perspective. Although it commercially ticked an incredible box, it was really almost a PR disaster when you looked at what happened with regards to the reaction of that on social media. BC, as the organisation, has got multiple things it needs to do. It needs to win medals. And of course, it then needs to make sure it goes away and increases participation, because Sport England want that and UK Sport want that. But then we've got this bit in the middle of the sandwich where we're interested. Who's going to look after and be the passionate supporter of the road racing scene in the UK in amongst all of that? I read about John's announcement. I can see, you know, he rides a bike himself, which is great. He's obviously done lots for cycling, which always helps. So I really hope that as far as his first phase in the business, and I'm going to use another big horrible corporate bingo words, in his discovery period, your first sort of 100 days or so, you should be asking a lot of questions and listening a lot. And I hope during that discovery period, he gets to read all of the strategic documents that have been written about what needs to be done. He goes and talks to all the people that have an active stakeholding in making this happen. Then he really does listen and then go away and begins to execute and do something. Because I don't think we're lacking ideas. We're not lacking resources, we're not lacking people who feel passionate about it. What we really need now is a bit of execution, don't we? Why don't we get things moving?
Well, absolutely. I mean, when we were talking off air, Phil, you mentioned that one of the challenges to getting things done will be the immediate departure of acting CEO Danielle Every. Now, Danny will leave British Cycling in spring 2023, according to the statement, so right about now. And she'll become the chief operating officer at the PGMOL, which oversees professional football referees and match officials in England. Now, I don't think anyone can criticise her effectiveness. She oversaw a number of detailed strategic initiatives at British Cycling, including 5-year plans for each of the Federation's 8 sporting disciplines. And for road cycling, that was The Road Ahead, published in 2021. Phil, just how does a large organisation gain and retain momentum when there are so many shifts at board level?
It's really, really difficult, particularly when you've got somebody that's been there a long time. They've understood it all. Sometimes you've got to really understand the wiring, how the work works. You've got one thing that can appear on a PowerPoint slide or a strategic slide, and then the reality of how the work actually gets done. Who does it? Who do you need to traffic things along and things like that? And clearly for me, at such an important time, if you're walking in as a new CEO and somebody as important as Danny is sort of at the same time going, well, I'm leaving, it leaves a big vacuum there. You don't have that knowledge that you can lean on, that person that becomes a sort of an important pillar in your first 3 months or so period. My view is that clearly something's going on. Clearly, there's something around the way the board is operating or the culture or something which is leading to this sort of dysfunction of some kind. Because look, you've got the governance, the constitution, you've got the organization, all of these things, but something is clearly happening, which is meaning this sort of rotating door of good people coming in and good people going out. There has to be a reason for it. And I think that when you look at some of the strategic documentation that has been created, you know, some of the things that I picked out, there was this particular sentence to be a modern and effective governing body where decision makers can be held to account. And I'm thinking, okay, well, all right, there's quite a few decision makers still there that probably also need to be held to account, where people are a bit frustrated. Here we all are. We've been talking on this podcast now for a while, and we know the people that are passionate. We know the people that are the doers. We know the people that are just getting on with it, regardless of all the politics that's going on in the governing body. They're just getting on and organizing races and just running teams, starting teams, doing stuff. And I think there's a sort of a growing frustration that the erosion that the scene is seeing is not being properly tackled. And I guess what this is, the rallying cry with the new CEO, and I'm sure he's going to be listening to the Brother Cycling podcast, Tim, is to say, why don't you come on here as a guest? Why don't you come talk to us? Why don't you come and talk to us about this scene? Why don't we get a few people on here and begin to chat about this? Because I'm sure there's some things that you could hear, which you could go away and action very quickly to kind of get things moving.
Well, I can only echo that. I mean, let's get John on the podcast. We're in Manchester. He's in Manchester. Let's get to the studio and hear what his vision is for British cycling, and we can provide a perspective as a sponsor that stood at the side of the domestic sport for nearly a decade. Just a final thought, Phil, before we leave this topic. Does John need to make some sort of gesture, some sort of policy initiative early in his leadership to acknowledge the scale of the challenge that the road scene is facing? Or should he instead make an early commitment to the road ahead strategy and say, we're going to see this through?
Yes, well, if it were me, so let's just assume that I'm putting on that hat for a moment. Of course, I'm going into my discovery phase, as I talked about earlier. I'm going into my stakeholder engagement phase, you know, bing, bing. I think we nearly got a line on the corporate bingo here, haven't we, Tim? But there is this document that exists, and it's called The Road Ahead, and it was created by Danny, signed off by the board. This is the strategy for the road to Paris and what they want to do about road scene and the number of volunteers that they need, marshals, erosion of teams, all of this stuff. So the first thing I'd be doing is I'd be getting out there and doing a couple of fairly big high profile interviews with the cycling media and appearing on a couple of podcasts and just going, okay, what is it you're saying? Here's what I think. Here's this document. And I'm determined to either bring this to life or do a review of it. Now, I do feel a bit sort of uncomfortable when you say those things, because you're basically then saying there's going to be another big delay. So if a lot of competent people have already written this document and your board has signed it off, then surely the accountability should be, we all believe in this. So your job as a CEO should then be to go away and start executing against it and go, okay, what do we need to do? What are the priorities? You start running a priority matrix, which is big, easy to do things that are in your control that you can get done quickly. You start working on those immediately. And what you do is you send messages to the market that something's changing. So those easy wins is where you're at. And I'd be out there personally, just engaging and getting the story out there that things are changing. I'm here now. Energy is going to change. Momentum's going to change. Somebody's new here, and we're going to go away and start solving these problems. That's what I would do. So I'm really hoping that we see a similar type of behavior from John.
Great stuff. Well, we would certainly welcome that, wouldn't we? New energy, positive statements, engagement with the media, and some reassurance that road cycling is at the top of British cycling's agenda. There has been a first annual review of the Road Ahead strategy, but certainly not the full-scale review that, as you say, Phil, would fall within John's remit if he's so minded. Phil, thanks very much indeed. I mean, some very valuable insights there. Well, one thing that British cycling can be credited with is its excellent stewardship of the national championships in recent years. We've had two cracking editions since the Road Ahead strategy was published in 2021 at Lincoln and then last year in Dumfries and Galloway. Now, since our last episode, they've announced the venues and courses for the 2023 national championships, which will be held in Redcar and Cleveland. And the first big takeaway, I guess, is that the three major disciplines, road, time trial and circuit, will again be decided at the same championships. That was a format introduced at Lincoln in 2021, and it seems to be a winning formula. I mean, who can forget Harry Tanfield and Ethan Hayter going wheel to wheel in the men's circuit race in Lincoln on the Friday, and then again 2 days later on Michaelgate. The headlines from the courses, I think, are that the time trials are going to be fast and flat. The circuit races will go along the Esplanade on Redcar's seafront, which will look great on television. And the road race is going to be very, very hard. There will be lots of climbing, including an ascent each lap of Saltburn Bank, which has a maximum gradient of more than 22%, as we saw back in 2019 when the Klondike Grand Prix was part of the National Road Series calendar. Sean, you'll have a much better perspective than either Phil or I on how these courses are going to feel. What was your initial reaction when they were unveiled?
My takeaway from looking at the road race course was, well, wow. Very, very hilly and contrasting to last year's course for sure, which was very, very flat in comparison to this year's course. The amount of climbing in this year's edition of the National Road Race Champs is quite daunting, to be honest. The main climb of Saltburn Bank looks incredibly steep with gradients over 20%, and it's certainly not a short climb either. So I think it's going to be really challenging and it's going to produce some worthy winners. The road race course doesn't look like it's going to suit me particularly well, to be honest. I wouldn't call myself a climber, so it will be interesting. I think it will be an iconic edition of the race. It will be really challenging. The time trial course is definitely contrasting to the road race, with it being more or less completely flat. And the crit doesn't look particularly complicated either, whereas the last corner for the crit last year was really tight and it was around 50 metres to go before the finish. So it was very much a fight into that last corner, whereas this year's course looks a little bit more simple. Most of the corners, I believe, are right angles, so although it will create a very fast, interesting race, it will be, I think, more of a normal crit than basically just a bum fight into that last corner.
And Phil, how did you respond to the courses when British Cycling lifted the lid on them?
Well, I thought it would be relatively easy to predict the time trial winner. Nothing too technical about that course in reality. So that's just going to come down to sort of straight high quality aerodynamics, isn't it? And whoever the current top time trial riders are probably going to be the favourite there. Bit like Sean, really. The circuit race looks like it's got a couple of dead turns in it, but they look fairly easy. And it looks like you've got a very long finish there on the circuit, which is great. So that should mean a good sprint for that final corner and pops a bunch finish or perhaps one rider getting off. We'll see. The road race, again, as a result of the course profile, is going to lend itself quite well to those climbers, and that will just become a bit attritional, won't it? Because that's a 7-lap race for the women, 10-lap race for the men. So we know how that one's going to work out, don't we? It's all going to roll off quite nicely together. And then by about the middle of the race, we're going to start seeing people pull away on those climbs with a view to sort of dropping out the weaker riders. So it's good. And I'm delighted at least we've got a good national championships there and some good courses, and I'm sure lots of people will be travelling to Redcar and Cleveland to go and support that.
Sean, you might be hoping for dry weather at least. I mean, Lincoln was grisly and Dumfries and Galloway was torrential.
Personally, I quite like racing in the rain. The national champs last year, I think, was probably the worst conditions I've ever raced in, but I loved it. To be honest, the wind, the rain, I think for me, the more challenging the conditions, the better, because to be honest, it doesn't really bother me. And I think if the conditions are bad and you can handle it, then you've beaten half the field before you've even started, because a lot of people do just switch off when they open the curtains in the morning and see rain and wind. And I definitely revel in those kinds of conditions. But it would be nice if we have a nice day. Yeah, it's definitely more enjoyable as you're racing. But for me, the conditions are less important than for other people, I think.
So here's a question for you both. Does the national champion's jersey make the rider, or does the rider make the national champion's jersey? Last year, we had a superstar win the men's race and a rising star win the women's race. So does the national champion's jersey gain in prestige when it's on the shoulders of Mark Cavendish? Or is the proof of its own power evidenced by the fact that Alice Towers is now competing in the Women's World Tour? Sian, let's start with you.
Certainly for Alice, I think having the national champs jersey has really elevated her as a rider, and she has gone from strength to strength this year. For example, the ride she did in Paris-Roubaix, where she spent the day in the breakaway, that was a really classy ride from her. And although before her performance at the national championships last year, we knew that she was a very talented rider, I think that really cemented her as a rider at the top of her game. And obviously she's really young still, but I think the national champs ride from her last year was just a sign of things to come, and she's certainly fulfilling that expectation now. In the men's side, obviously, Cavendish is one of the best riders of the generation, and for him, having achieved so much already, the national champs isn't as big of an achievement as his record equaling number of Tour de France victories, his world championship, but it's always a privilege to wear the national champs jersey. I'd certainly love to one day, but for the teams as well that have national champions on their roster, I think it elevates that as well.
And how about you, Phil? Is the British champions jersey somehow more prestigious because Mark Cavendish is inside it? Or do you take the opposite view, that it's the jersey that makes the rider? And as Sian says, Alice Towers might be taken as exhibit A for that argument.
For me, six of one and a half, a dozen of the other, really, Tim, isn't it? And this is the joy of how the Nationals are raced. Very, very different to many other road races because, of course, you know, when some of these top World Tour pros come back, they don't have their teams around them in the same way. And so they're sort of having to dogfight back in the dirty end of racing again, where it's sort of every person for themselves. And I think when we saw Mark Cavendish come with this absolute determination to try and win it, he wanted the kudos of that jersey because he loves the scene so much, and everybody when we want to see him in it. But equally, as we've just described there, from someone like Alice, it can be used as a spotlight. It jacks you up. It puts you up suddenly in the shop window for a lot of Conti teams and, of course, World Tour teams. And so I think it does both, really. And, you know, the kudos at the World Tour of wearing a national champions jersey, you know, if you're in the World Tour and you haven't got your national champions jersey on, I think everyone's looking at you and, you know, finger pointing and sort of saying, okay, well, I'm a national champion, aren't you? It can help with negotiations. It can help with kudos. It can help with everything. Of course it can. But actually, do you know what? For the scene itself, what we really want is just people who earn that jersey. And I think to come to a Nationals, and if you earn that jersey just out of your own volition, your ability as a rider, then I don't mind if you're a World Tour pro or just a domestic rider. If you beat everybody on the day, you've won the right to wear it.
Well, let's take a look now at the sport from its grassroots. I mentioned Mark Etches in the introduction, organiser of the Sheffield Grand Prix and the Monsal Hill Climb. Now, Mark, to borrow one of your phrases, Phil, is a doer, and we'll hear from him in a moment. But let's just put some context around this. There have been several National B races since our last episode on March the 23rd, including the Timmy James Memorial Grand Prix, which will certainly resonated with you, Sian. I know that Tim was a very close friend of yours, and your dad, Mark Botley, organised the race. From that perspective, all of these National Bees coming along, you can understand the frustrations of people like Mark, who object to people describing the scene as dying. To offer a different perspective, there has only been one National A race since our last episode, and that was the Inexo Cams Women's Cycle Classic. So those are two quite different dynamics. I mean, is this evidence of a thriving grassroots scene, or is it evidence of a neglected elite scene? Or is it a bit of both? Mark Etches can certainly give us a view, so let's hear now from Mark.
We can see all the great stuff going on. We're only in April already, and we feel like we've had a cracking season of National Bees already. You see high-profile now athletes who are on the World Tour, etc., criticising or saying now the scene's dead. The scene is not dead. You know, that's when I sort of had an interview with the Yorkshire Post, me and Giles Pidcock sort of said our piece, because there's a breaking point at some point where you feel you have to sort of bat your corner. And me going to these events and seeing all these people working hard, you know, these are my friends. And when you think, right, hang on, guys, you know, we're being criticised here by people who actually probably don't really know enough about grassroots as it stands at the moment. I'm far from a keyboard warrior. I see a lot of negativity on social media. I think the primary one is, you know, what do British cycling do, etc. You know, everybody moans about British cycling. Why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? And British Cycling are the national governing body, just like the FAI is for football. So they make sure that the clubs, officials, volunteers, coaches, etc. are fit for purpose. They work behind the scenes for that and provide the platform to be able to organise races. They're not throwing money out right, left and centre like people think. The magic bullet here is not British Cycling. They are going to remain as the national governing body, give us direction and help with any questions we have. There's regional event officers that can help if we have any queries, the regional boards. There's all that sort of infrastructure in place. But they don't, well, they do organise races because of the national championships this year. Jonathan Day and the crew have managed to pull in up in the Northeast, the national championships. So they're working on that blue chip event, which is brilliant. And they're working hard behind the scenes at that, which again, people on social media might not see. I guess we were a little bit perturbed the other year when British Cycling pulled the broadcast from under us. But when we actually looked at it, the actual value, what British Cycling were paying, it just wasn't there. You know, I intend this year to try and live stream, as we've done with Otley and Ilkley, etc. Live stream Sheffield Grand Prix, so it goes out to a bigger audience. And if that's out via YouTube, Facebook, etc., that's good for me. We keep an eye on, the viewing figures again. We've all watched probably Paris-Roubaix yesterday on GCN. So it's a platform a lot of fans are familiar with, and it's a click of a button, I guess, then to watch Lincoln Grand Prix. You know, that would be really good. How much that would cost, you know, maybe we should find that out. Maybe it's a good avenue to go down.
So wonderful to hear that from Mark Etches, who, as I mentioned, organises the Sheffield Grand Prix and the Monsal Hill Climb. I should also mention that Mark is a BC certified commissaire and a dedicated volunteer with Yorkshire's White Rose Youth League, which has produced, among others, a certain Tom Pidcock and Connor Swift. So, John, you're a rider. You're absolutely at the heart of this. Is BC neglecting the National Road Series, or are they pursuing the right strategy in rebuilding from the bottom up? Is Mark right to object when people say that the scene is dying?
It's difficult to say that the scene is dying, to be honest. From my perspective, having ridden quality National B races and a quality National A race in the Cycle Classic, I think the standard of women's racing has gone through the roof, really, over the last couple of years. And the Cycle Classic, as always, run excellently. It was faultless and it attracted a really quality field. And although the quantity of National A races has reduced down to 6 from maybe 8 in previous years, the races are of a higher quality than ever, I think.
And what about the absence of television coverage? I mean, wearing his organiser's hat, Mark sort of grudgingly accepts British Cycling's analysis that its Eurosport deal didn't deliver value for money, but GCN has delivered a revolution since then. I mean, surely even the keenest grassroots race organiser, and it's hard to think of one keener than Mark, can't be expected to fund a television deal. I mean, live streaming Facebook, it's a great initiative, but it's not in the same ballpark as coverage on GCN. And that responsibility has to lie with British Cycling, doesn't it?
You're still getting decent coverage from the likes of Monument HQ, who have been producing some really nice kind of highlight videos that do get the race out there. TV coverage, I think, is definitely missing, and that definitely requires the Federation to come in and chuck a decent chunk of money at it to get it back to that level. And you're right, certainly, in saying that the TV coverage will attract sponsors, and that will definitely go a big way towards it.
And what about the racing? What does this new landscape of high-quality NatBs and occasional National As look like from the saddle? Already this year, you've ridden a brilliant National B race in the form of the Peaks 2-Day and an amazing National A race in the Inexo Cams Cycle Classic.
Certainly looking at the National B scene, it's stronger than ever. And having ridden races such as the Peaks 2-Day, the Fat Creations race down at Goodwood, the quality of those races was probably as high as a National A race that I would have ridden last year. And I think for both of those races, the Fat Creations race and the Peaks 2-Day, I think the quality was the same. The fields were slightly smaller, but the difference was because the fields were smaller, the people that weren't doing those races were the people that perhaps wouldn't finish a National A anyway. So the quality is really high. And I think because of the smaller number of National A races and the fact that races such as the Team Cup that we did at the weekend exclude the continental riders, that then means that the National B races that aren't part of the Team Cup are elevated to a higher standard because the continental riders as there are fewer races for them available to do, they're flooding to those National B races and making them a really high quality.
And how about the style of racing? Has this new landscape, you know, where fewer National A races mean that Conti teams now turn up regularly to second tier events, has that changed the way that National Bs are raced?
I think before this year, quite a high proportion of National B races would end in a bunch sprint of some description. Certainly the Dave Peck only once before Route to Victory the other day had it ended in a breakaway victory. Every other year it had been a bunch sprint. And I think the only race this year that has finished in a bunch sprint was the Easter Classic at Castlecombe. Every other race has been raced really aggressively and has finished in a breakaway. And I think that is testament to how high the level is, certainly from a riding perspective. And I think now that the racing is becoming much more exciting to watch and much more engaging, I think that is a really good sign for the future. And hopefully that will attract more sponsors.
And how about from a sponsor's point of view, Phil? Is a thriving grassroots scene with high quality coverage from the specialist cycling media, is that enough to satisfy a major business? Or is there no substitute for blue ribbon races like the Lincoln Grand Prix and television coverage like we enjoy for the national championships?
I think it just always depends, Tim, what your business does and what audience you're trying to reach, whether you're trying to reach a mass audience or a local audience. And I think what I just heard Sean describing there was the quality of racing is still really high. It's just on the A's. It just needs the quantity back. You know, if we could get a couple more races onto that schedule again, happy days. It doesn't mean, because there's a slightly reduced schedule, that the quality is any different. In fact, you could argue, we said this on the last podcast, I think, if I recall, Tim, that the quality of the B racing's gone up as well as a result of what you just said there, Sean, that Conti riders going, well, actually, I want a race. I need my race fitness at a certain level. So they're going back to the Bs and the quality's still there. And I think that's a topic that we shouldn't let drop. There's an observation that's there. It's just that what we've seen is a little bit of a period of time when we've seen a couple of teams fold, a couple of races go off the calendar, and suddenly that's it, the whole world's imploded. It hasn't. There's still lots of really great stuff going on here. But I think we're in an age now. Back in the day, what was the business model of cycling? Dead easy, slap it on the telly, reach tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, pass me a payment, I can make sure you get eyeballs on your brand. Isn't it marvellous? But of course, things have changed a lot, haven't they, for brands now? We're into content, we're into engagement, we're into direct marketing. We want to understand how we can connect directly with customers fundamentally. And I think from a connectivity point of view, that whole thing's not properly tied up yet with regards to sort of how do we connect the scene properly. So individual races are very much sort of left to their own devices. So Lincoln are off to go and get their own sponsor. They do all their own work, and that one individual wraps up that one race, that sort of one big brand. If we could just have, I think, a slightly better connected sponsorship strategy, certainly for the A's and B's, and that obviously would probably have to be coordinated by the Federation, then that would be a really great start. You know, some years ago, I always observed that when they had the big flagship sponsors like HSBC at BC, their whole strategies were based around mass audiences and mass participation. So they were interested in Olympic medals and fundamentally, you know, tens of thousands of kids on bikes in parks and all those sorts of things. And I always felt that the road racing scene should have been sold as a separate asset. So sell that one to a brand that's interested in the road racing scene, who can create credibility, help create engagement, help build marketing plans, help build the whole lot as a more coherent pillar, rather than just selling it to one brand that owns it all. So my view would be they should all be sold individually. The rights should be sold individually so that you begin to grow a category with a certain brand that's got more of an interest to grow it. You know, from my point of view, it is what it is. If you're a cycling brand, if you're a new bike manufacturer or you're a startup kit manufacturer and you want to go around to all these races with a little tent up and you want to sell direct, why not? But for bigger brands, then I think because there is a difficulty to coordinate activity like this, it's less of a proposition. And that's probably where Sweet Spot have more of a capability, because they can be a bit more joined up in driving together digital campaigns, as well as mass broadcast media, email marketing, custom data collection, social. You can have a much more, what we call, integrated marketing campaign. I'd love to see a way where we can perhaps move the domestic road racing seed outside of those things at Sweet Spot, get a bit more integrated. And if it does, that creates the platform to attract more brands in my opinion.
Well, thank you both for such very detailed responses, Sean on the sporting side and Phil on the commercial side. I mean, there is an interesting parallel, I think, and that's the portfolio approach that both teams and sponsors are adopting. Phil, you've done it for some years now with Brother Cycling. The big professional televised races like the Tour of Britain and the Women's Tour, they give us eyeballs and brand exposure, while our sponsorship of grassroots teams shows where our heart is. We're at the side of the sport. Sean, you mentioned earlier in the episode that Hutchinson Brother UK is racing in Belgium at the weekend. You'll do National A races, you'll do National B races, you'll race overseas. It seems to me, at least, that the road scene in its current form demands a sort of mix and match approach, whether you're a sponsor, a team, or a rider. And as Phil says, a more joined up approach would benefit everybody. Well, you gave me a very nice link there, Phil, to Sweet Spot and the Women's Tour, because they're next on our agenda. I caught up earlier this week with Peter Hodges, Sweet Spot's PR and marketing director, and somebody who knows the sport inside out. Sweet Spot, of course, organises the Tour of Britain, the Women's Tour, and the Tour Series. Now, sadly, since our last episode, Sweet Spot has announced the postponement of the Women's Tour in 2023, citing increased running costs, reduced commercial support, and the lack of a vehicle sponsor. So let's hear now from Peter.
So we announced the decision on the 31st of March on a Friday morning. The decision was sort of officially made earlier that week, probably on the Monday afternoon or the Tuesday morning. But obviously we wanted to let stakeholders know and work with the partners of the events, the likes of Brother, Cottages.com, Cycle Guard, etc. But also the stakeholders, the venues that we'd announced, the likes of the UCI, British Cycling, the teams, the partners and suppliers that supply us with the podiums and so forth, and also the staff. So a lot of people to consult, and we wanted to do it properly, put the announcement together and all be coordinated and singing off the same hymn sheet, if you like. The last few years, if you like, since the 2019 edition, you know, costs have gone up. With inflation, we reckon costs are about 20% higher than last year. The main ones is hotels and the logistics, the petrol. But if you think that all of our suppliers, so for example, say the company that supplies the podium, well, their costs have gone up, their staff costs have gone up, and that gets obviously passed on to us. While perhaps now we don't have so many sort of COVID mitigation costs, there's still things that are a legacy of the pandemic. The great example of that being that before the pandemic, on the race, we have around 40 police officers, and they all used to be in twin rooms. But since the pandemic, they've needed to be in single rooms. So you go from having 20 rooms a night to 40 rooms a night, times that by the number of nights in the race, and it all starts adding up. I mean, one of the reasons why the car situation was such a challenge, and firstly, we have to say, you know, in no way should it be negative towards Scope. They've supported the event since it started in 2014. They've supported the men's tour since 2011. So they've been a fantastic partner, and we've been spoiled by their involvement. The auto industry, again, is still, if you like, struggling to get over from the pandemic and the chip crisis. You know, the last couple of years, we've had some strange fleets, if you like, from Skoda, where in the past, they'd all be sort of the same models. There's been weird issues of trying to get cars with sunroofs. It's a very complicated and not at all an expert, obviously, on the auto market. A lot of car companies we went to were saying, you know, oh, we've not got any money. But equally, more importantly, we haven't got the fleet at the moment, or we haven't got the access to this, or we can't let that number of vehicles go out. The other, it's mainly the absence of new money. Obviously, we've mentioned the example of Skoda stepping back, which was the main loss. The 2022 Women's Tour, hopefully your listeners will have noticed, it was the Women's Tour. Every previous edition has been, you know, we've had the Friends Life, the Aviva, the Ovo Energy, even the AJ Bell Women's Tour. The 2022 race was actually the first one without a title sponsor. It's important to note, yes, we did say, you know, reduced commercial support, but we did still have the support of, obviously, Brother, Accurist, Cottages.com, Cycle Guard. So there are brands out there that are involved, that are supporting cycling and supporting women's cycling, and have done for a number of years. But if you like, it's the bringing new and also bringing, you know, we all know the cycle industry is in a challenging place. I'm sure everyone that's listening, you know, we've seen announcements from the likes of Strava and Wahoo cutting back, but also people like More Large, the distributor, sadly ceasing to exist. So there is a problem across the site. So like cycle industry support, which might involve value in kind and so forth, is reduced. But it's really trying to get in those sponsors from outside of the sport, the likes of the AJ Bells, the Friends Lifes, Ovo Energies. Sadly, men's sport, not just men's cycling, men's sport is still an easier sell. I suppose it's got the, if you like, the however long a history and, you know, that natural bias. I remember when we first started the women's tour in 2014 and Guy Elliott gave us a fact and it was something ridiculous, like 2% of global sports sponsorship went into women's sport and 98% into men's. It was one of those facts that you really had to like, can I see the source for this? Because it was absolutely bonkers. And I'm sure that's obviously improved and we see great things like the Barclays Super League and, you know, Vitality have been in netball and the 100 and so forth. But it's definitely not 50-50. And, you know, there are reasons for that because obviously the sport is still growing. If we talk specifically about cycling, if people are basing it on the returns of media values, well, our, for example, social media numbers, website numbers are still growing. They aren't yet one-to-one for the men's tour of Britain. So there is a certain amount where naturally you'd expect someone to say, well, actually, if I'm doing this as a pure advertising play, I'm getting more eyeballs on the men's race than I am on the women's, so that's my focus. But again, brands that I've mentioned before, the likes of Brother, Cottages, Acura Cycle, are supporting both events, and indeed partners have in the past, because the beautiful thing we've got is a product where we can go, well, tell you what, we've got a fantastic week-long with women's race in June, a fantastic week-long men's race in September. You can have both of them and support both of them.
So great to hear there from Peter Hodges, Sweet Spot's PR and Marketing Director, and a man who's closer to the hiatus of the women's tour than pretty much anybody else. Well, let's begin, Sian, by asking you to describe the impact that the women's tour hiatus will have on domestic cycling. I mean, at a first glance, it's a professional race on the UCI Women's World Tour, and you'd imagine it would have no immediate effect on the domestic women's calendar, but it will have a tremendous impact as a halo event, you know, an inspirational race that can pull 300,000 people to Britain's roadsides.
I think it's going to have a massive effect, to be honest. As you said, it's a really aspirational thing for British female riders to be able to go on a ride and watch the best riders in the world ride through their hometown. It's certainly very inspirational and that will be missed, I think. For riders of my level, it's also very inspirational because for me to step up to a continental team, which isn't beyond the realms of possibility with our team or making a move to another British team, the women's tour is very within reach, and that is a race at the top of the world, really. And for that to be so close to home is very inspirational and motivates you to train hard because it's tangible that you can be there. So that race being missing from the calendar, obviously, hopefully it is only going to be a 1 year hiatus, but it is definitely concerning and it's going to be a big hole, I think.
Phil, do you think we'll see the return of the women's tour next year? I mean, we're likely still to be living in an inflationary economy, still facing the same economic headwinds. But if the history of professional cycling teaches us anything, it's that sponsors come and sponsors go. I mean, there's always new money available. There's always new companies seeking new opportunities to promote their brands. So how do you read this situation?
Well, Tim, I can tell you that I did actually have dinner with the chief executive of Sweet Spot a couple of weeks ago. And so over dinner, we were able to really talk about this situation in quite a lot of detail. And obviously, there's some elements of it that I certainly wouldn't discuss here. But I think you've heard from Peter that you've come to a certain point where you go, we're lacking a title sponsor and we're lacking a vehicle sponsor. No chief exec in the world can look at that and say, well, it's okay, we'll just reach into our pockets and fund it out of our own pocket. The gap is just too big. So you have to make these big calls to say, look, this is it. Because you're looking at serious sums of money here, £500,000-£600,000, just cover the costs before you make anything. And you're right, police charges have gone up. Everything's gone up. Fuel's gone up. Now, suddenly you want to try and rent rental cars to replace the Skoda fleet. They're not available. And the cars that are available are not fit for purpose, or they're that expensive, it becomes unaffordable. It's very, very difficult. And I can really understand, as somebody that leads a business, why they had to make that decision. But I can tell you this, they are redoubling their efforts to find the title sponsor. They recently appointed a brand new managing director at Sweet Spot. That was the reason for our dinner, was for me to meet that individual. Very experienced person, big, big background in client acquisition, business development, all that kind of good stuff. And they absolutely are determined to solve this issue. From my point of view, the reason they'd come up, they're doing a bit of a tour, is they're going around, they're visiting all the councils, visiting potential sponsors, talking to business networking groups, trying to uncover that layer now of who those new names could be to bring that fresh money to bear to sponsor the races, the big ticket races, the Women's Tour, Tour of Britain. These both need title sponsors that have got deep pockets, you know, you've got to be able to put 500 to a million on the table for the rights for that race. You've got to be a company of a certain size to do that. So, you know, my job is to try and, I guess, assist them in pointing to a few of the businesses that for certainly I know, for example, in the Northwest that are doing well, and also businesses nationally where I think they ought to be having conversations because they're experiencing fast growth. And when you're experiencing fast growth, it means you're doing well. And when you're doing well, you normally have money to invest in discretionary expenditure, as we've talked before. So my view would be I've got high levels of confidence that the team at Sweet Spot are determined to solve this problem for 2024.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I mean, we've worked closely with the guys at Sweet Spot over the years, and they are very commercially astute. What a wonderful example, Phil, of at your side, that you're looking out on their behalf almost for sponsors who might fit the bill. I mean, that's absolutely brilliant.
The other thing that we discussed is there's got to be a point here where, you know, my view was when we had this issue with the women's tour, you know, for me, I'd have walked it straight into central government. I would. I would have gone straight to the culture minister and I would have just gone, right, this race is too big for our economy, too big to let this one have a hiatus. And as we know, money can be fairly easily found and distributed within government departments if the optics look good. So to have 500,000, 1 million people stood at the roadside all feeling good about the world for a payment of 500 grand to maybe rescue that race for the season, I think would have been a fairly good proposition. Unfortunately, the timescales they had were just a bit too short. But my view would be is that actually they should be working on those relationships now to also in the future, if they're faced with this issue, that they can walk that into somebody that may be able to kind of write that check if needs be. Because nationally, we need it. The nation needs it. We need this huge, huge race that's on the telly all over the world that says women's racing, here it is in the UK. This is the place to be. It has all sorts of impacts on tourism and wider GVA, gross value add, you know, the money that comes into local economies. And so governments are interested in that stuff, Tim. Governments love that stuff. And so I think the proposition moving forward for me would be how to make sure that we've also got government involved at this sort of level for races of this particular standard.
And they absolutely should be concerned that a race like the Women's Tour won't go ahead this year. Everyone is signed up, and rightly so, to the promotion of women's sport. You know, the Women's Tour is not just a great British race. The riders in the Women's World Tour peloton say it's the best stage race on the calendar, and women's racing is something that this country does extremely well. Sean, you, of course, are much, much closer to it than Phil and I. Were you surprised that there wasn't some kind of late rescue package?
I was certainly surprised. I think there had been concerns about the race for a little while, but I really thought that there would be a last minute saviour for it. And yeah, obviously the conversations that you've had, Phil, with Sweet Spot are reassuring by the sounds of it. I was certainly surprised that nobody came along to save it for this year because yeah, it is really important and it's too good of a race to let go for a year. When you watch it on TV and you see hundreds of school kids at the side of the road looking at what they could become in 10, 15 years' time. I think letting that go is really sad. But yeah, we can only hope that it will be saved for future years.
Let's start to bring this episode to a close. We've discussed some very complex issues today, and I think we've been able to provide some really valuable insights. The domestic calendar is now in full swing. There's been no shortage of National B races, as we've discussed in some depth, and next month we'll see National A races for men and women at the same event for the first time this season at the Lincoln Grand Prix. Now, Lincoln, for many people, is the jewel in the crown of the domestic calendar, a blue chip, blue ribbon event, so we'll definitely look forward to that. The second round of Cold Dark North's proper Northern Road Race series at Oakenclough on April the 30th. Will be among several National B events in the weeks ahead, and listen out for our special edition with co-founder Deb John. Sean, I guess you're already thinking about the second round of the British Women's Team Cup, the Banbury Star Race, which takes place on Sunday, May the 21st. Are you looking forward to that already?
I am looking forward to it. I've never done particularly well there in the past because that climb is quite hard. Edge Hill, I think we take it on three times and it's quite steep, quite long. And yes, it's a very challenging course for a National B. But now that we've got the likes of the Peaks 2 Day, that's becoming the norm to have a challenging course like that. The finish of that certainly suits me. if I can make it over the challenging climb of Edge Hill, then hopefully I will be able to achieve a good result there. But that race falls the weekend before we as a team are off to a stage race in the Czech Republic. So that will be a good form-finding race for the following week.
Well, let's wrap up now with a social shout-out. If you want to follow any of our guests, here's where to find them. Mark Etches, that's Mark with a C, is on Twitter at @Mark_Etches, and he's on Instagram at @Mark_Etches, all one word. Peter Hodges is on Twitter and on Instagram at @PeterDHodges. Sean, if people want to follow you on social media, how do they go about that?
Yeah, it's Sean Botterley on Instagram and on Twitter as well. Not that I'm particularly active on Twitter, so I'd probably just stay ahead for the Instagram.
And that's all one word, I think. SianBotterley. And Phil, you're on Twitter, of course.
Yes, you can find me at Roadphil. So just rhymes with roadkill, but put a fill in instead of the kill.
Easy mistake to make. And then finally, of course, you can follow Brother Cycling. We're at Brother Cycling on all three channels. Thank you very much indeed, Phil. Thank you very much indeed, Sean. And thank you very much indeed, everybody out there, for listening.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.